Good evening and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, this week with me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a talk show about ideas, and those ideas normally have something to do with the Enlightenment. That means things like freedom of expression, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. Of course, that means as well as these things, you're likely to find us talking about their opposites, things like superstition, religious fundamentalism, totalitarianism, censorship, and conspiracy theory. Each episode of Little Atoms features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And tonight's guest is Professor Catherine S. Olmsted. Catherine Olmsted is Professor of History at the University of California, Davis. She is the author of Challenging the Secret Government, the Post-Watergate Investigations of the CIA and FBI, and Red Spy Queen, a biography of Elizabeth Bentley. Her latest book, which we'll be talking about tonight, is Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories in American Democracy, from World War I to 9/11. So I'm speaking to Catherine S. Olmsted. Cathy, thank you very much for agreeing to speak to Little Atoms this afternoon.
Sure, glad to be here.
So we're going to be talking about the book Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories in American Democracy, from World War I to 9/11. And it's a book about conspiracy theories, and you look at a number of examples, which we'll go into a bit more detail a bit later. But what you're not trying to do in the book is you're not looking at the conspiracy theories in a way as if to sort of answer, is this correct? Is this theory right or wrong? You're more trying to explore the idea behind how have we got to the position where people believe these things. I mean, would that be correct to say?
Yes, absolutely. I was not interested in trying to prove or disprove these conspiracy theories, because there have been a lot of books about that. And you know, even just a book on the Kennedy assassination, you can spend 1,000 pages just looking at the physical evidence. And so I wasn't so much interested in that as in looking at why so many Americans believe that their government, because those are the conspiracy theories I focus on, is anti-government conspiracy theories, why they believe that the people that they have elected are conspiring against them.
Okay, so we'll go back right to the beginning of the book then, and you mentioned that it's about particularly government conspiracy theories. Let's talk about when that actually started. Why did people start to believe that the government might be involved in conspiring against them, or in just involved in conspiracy theories, as opposed to, say, other groups of people? I mean, you mentioned that once upon a time Americans would be concerned about, say, the Catholics or the Jews and things like that, but there's a distinct point where it became the government that was the focus.
Yes. Right about World War I, I think there's a real transition there, where before World War I, there had been Americans who believed that there were from time to time individuals in the government who were conspiring against them. But the more popular conspiracy theories were about various ethnic or racial groups, or about communists or bankers. And then in World War I, that's the time in the United States when you get the birth of the modern state, where the government really expands and takes on a whole lot of new powers, including the criminalization of dissent. In World War I, the U.S. Congress passes a couple of laws that make it illegal to interfere with recruiting for the war. And this is interpreted very broadly, and many people are put in jail for criticizing the U.S. participation in the First World War. And so as the government gets bigger and more powerful and starts having these surveillance agencies to enforce these espionage and sedition acts, then that is the point where Americans really start to feel fear the government as an institution. It's not just individuals within the government, but the government itself that they believe is actually conspiring against them.
Has that been a consistent theme? I mean, we can come right up to the modern day and see that the Bush administration, you know, ironically, one of the tactics of its crusade to go out around the world and protect our noble freedoms was by curtailing a lot of civil liberties at home immediately. I mean, has that been a consistent theme, do you think, right throughout the 20th century and into the 21st?
Right. I think Americans start to believe that their government is lying and covering up and conspiring, because it is starting to lie and cover up and conspire. And it's around 1917, 1918, where the U.S. government actually gets big enough to carry out conspiracies. Mm-hmm. So that's when there start being conspiracy theories directed against it.
Well, that's an important point as well, isn't it? The size of the fact that
before that point, the government just didn't have the resources to carry out these conspiracies on any sort of level. Or the, I mean, yeah, there was obviously the growth of the FBI and law enforcement agencies as well, which sort of run in parallel to that.
Right. It's in World War One that you get what some historians call a surveillance state in the United States, where you start getting agencies whose job it is to follow citizens around and see if they are guilty of subversion, broadly defined. And that really gets institutionalized during the war, and then immediately after the First World War, here in the U.S., we have what we call the First Red Scare, where there's just a wave of fear that there's going to be a communist revolution, and lots of government raids and deportations of suspected communists. And it's at that point where the Bureau of Investigation starts collecting these index cards, hundreds of thousands of them, listing Americans and their supposedly subversive connections. So that's when the government starts really watching people, and so that's when Americans start to fear that they're being watched.
Because they are being watched.
Right, exactly. So, you know, the saying is even paranoids have real enemies, and so that's where I get the title for
the First World War, and of course the same thing goes for the lead-up to the Second World War. There was a lot of opposition to Americans' involvement in the war, and clearly both Woodrow Wilson in the First World War and Roosevelt in the Second World War both basically wanting to get the US involved in the European War, and a lot of opposition both in among the American public and in, you know, and in the American government as well. So there is a conspiracy there, isn't there, if we want to call it that. There's obviously something going on where there is covert machinations going on within the government.
Right, that's an excellent point. In both of those cases, you had presidents who were strongly sympathetic to the British and wanting to get involved in the European war before the majority of Americans were. And so there's a certain amount of deception in their public statements, and that Franklin Roosevelt in particular is saying over and over again, we have no intention of getting involved in the war, when he really did want to get involved in the war. And so it's that sort of anger and fear that they're being manipulated by the president that leads some people to believe that he actually, you know, set up the Pearl Harbor attack for his own, you know, nefarious goals.
Pearl Harbor is the next example I wanted to raise, because there are a number of threads in the book, the conspiracies that were real, that were enacted by the government, and a number of, you know, the classic ones, Pearl Harbor being one, JFK perhaps being the other best example, where there really were conspiracies. I mean, these are things that people think are the classic conspiracy theories. There were conspiracies going on, but it perhaps turns out, if I can phrase it like this, that there were conspiracy theories that were done for reasons different to what conspiracy theorists would think. There were conspiracy theories that were perhaps done for, if not the right reasons, but for what the people committing them at the time would think were for the best possible motives.
Right, right. Well, what Roosevelt did not want a big investigation into Pearl Harbor during war, for the very good reason that the U.S. had broken Japanese diplomatic code, and the Japanese were still using that code.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually would hurt the war effort for him to have told the commission that was investigating the intelligence failure at Pearl Harbor all of the details about U.S. code-breaking operations, because then the Japanese might have found out that the U.S. had broken their code and then, of course, changed them, and that would have hurt U.S. code-breaking efforts in the U.S. military effort in the war. So for the very best of reasons, he said, you know, we can't investigate this right now, and we can't tell all that we know. You have an even more complicated situation with Lyndon Johnson, the president after John Kennedy was shot. Johnson set up a commission to investigate Kennedy's death as an attempt to stop the conspiracy theories about the Kennedy assassination. He believed that they were very dangerous, and the conspiracy theories might lead Americans to conclude that Fidel Castro of Cuba had killed Kennedy, which in turn, Johnson believed, could lead to a nuclear confrontation between the Soviets and the Americans. And so, in other words, conspiracy theories about the Kennedy assassination literally could lead to the end of the world. So he thought, okay, I must do everything I can to stop these conspiracy theories. I must have this official investigation that immediately declares that Kennedy was the victim of a lone gunman. But ironically, President Johnson himself believed in conspiracy theories about the Kennedy assassination. And because he knew that Kennedy's CIA had been trying to kill Castro, Johnson personally believes that Castro had actually succeeded in killing Kennedy. Now, there's no evidence for this, and I personally don't believe it, but the interesting thing is that Johnson believed it. So even as he is insisting publicly There's no conspiracy. He himself believes in a conspiracy, but he thinks that having other people believe in this could potentially lead to hundreds of millions of deaths, and so he must therefore help launch a cover-up.
So, as we've said, one of the major themes of the book is the idea that, you know, the government has in itself, over the, by growing and by enacting various conspiracies, has basically created the atmosphere in which these conspiracy theories can grow. And most conspiracy theorists believe that, you know, the government is this all-powerful organisation that is nefariously controlling things. But what's great here is that they all believe that as well. You know, like you said, Lyndon Johnson believes it. There's a great scene where you talk about Bill Clinton when he first becomes president, getting his friend into the Justice Department and saying, "I want to know whether there's UFOs and who killed Kennedy."
Right. Yes, the conspiracy theories are not limited to the fringe in the United States. Sometimes the people at the very center of power have their own conspiracy theories.
Why is that, do you think? I mean, is this, you know, we can think back to something like Hofstadter and, you know, the paranoid style of American politics. What is it about American politics that makes everybody from the grassroots up to the president fall prey to this sort of thinking?
Right. Well, I think that in Clinton's case and Lyndon Johnson's case, it was because they had access to secret information, and so they knew that the U.S. government was carrying out conspiracies. You know, in Johnson's case, he knew that the CIA had been trying to kill foreign leaders, and so he thought, well, given that I know there have been these conspiracies, I think there might be other conspiracies, or that we are conspiring against Castro, and so therefore Castro might be conspiring against us. So in a way, it wasn't paranoia on his part, it was sort of a logical conclusion.
You mentioned the same thing in terms of Richard Nixon as well, in that, you know, there was this period where he decided to sort of gain popularity himself, that he was going to try and smear previous Democratic presidents by revealing various conspiracies that they had been involved in.
Right, yeah. Nixon was the ultimate cynic as president, and that when he was starting to suffer from the Watergate scandal, he decided that one technique that he could use to discredit his enemies and to save himself would be to publicly come forward with evidence of other conspiracies in the U.S. government, in U.S. history, so that he could say, yes, I conspired, but look, everybody does it. And so he, at one point, even ordered some of his aides to go in the National Archives and look for evidence that Franklin Roosevelt had known that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked, or that John Kennedy had ordered the assassination of the president of South Vietnam. And in one case, one of Nixon's aides even faked government documents to try and, quote-unquote, prove that Kennedy had ordered this assassination. And so, you know, Nixon's strategy was to discredit all of his predecessors in order to save himself. And it didn't work for him, and it only succeeded in convincing a lot of Americans that, yes, their government was conspiring all the time against them. And so you couldn't trust anyone, not only Nixon, but, you know, no president could be trusted with power, and therefore the government couldn't be trusted with power. So a lot of, you know, the effect of Watergate and the revelations after Watergate of various government conspiracies contributed to the whole anti-government trend in the United States since the 1970s and the reluctance of Americans to give their government power to solve collective problems.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Catherine S. Olmsted, and we're talking about her book, Real Enemies. Catherine, one of the other really ironic points that comes out a lot in the book is that people constantly believe that governments are conspiring and, you know, they're coming up with these plots. And, you know, as we've established, yes, they are. You know, they actually are. But one of the reasons that people believe this is because of things like the Freedom of Information Act. So although on the one hand the government are conspiring, they're also being absolutely free with the information. So all of this stuff is eventually coming out into the public realm. And for instance, a really big theme in a lot of contemporary conspiracy theories is something called Operation Northwoods, which I'd like you to perhaps talk a little bit more about, because it's not something we've discussed on the show before. But it's worth saying before we talk about it that this is something that only came out because of new Freedom of Information Act. So you could just go into the archives as a member of the public and find this stuff yourself.
Right. You're absolutely right. That is one of the ironies that I explore in the book, is that because the United States is a democracy and also a superpower, you have this contradiction where it is the government is conspiring, but then a few years later, it does often allow ordinary citizens to see these documents about the conspiracies, which then, of course, leads Americans to believe in other conspiracy theories about the government. In the case of Northwoods, it was a proposed program from the early 1960s where the American Joint Chiefs of Staff, so the heads of the various military branches in the United States, proposed to President John Kennedy that they stage fake terrorist attacks on the United States and make them look like they came from Cuba, thus providing a pretext for the United States to invade Cuba and depose Fidel Castro. And this is all laid out in clinical detail, and there are many, you know, just horrifying parts of it. They propose shooting down a civilian airliner, although they do suggest that they could get the passengers off secretly at some point before it shot down, but they don't say what they're going to do with those passengers. And, you know, shooting down an American rocket in space and killing the astronaut, things like this, so that these horrifying crimes against Americans that would then lead the American people to support an invasion of Cuba. And this is all laid out in 1962. There's no record of what the president said specifically about this plan, which was called Operation Northwoods, apparently to mislead anyone who came across it, because it's actually about the Caribbean, not about the Northwoods, of course. But anyway, about a month after this was proposed to President Kennedy, he did let the Joint Chiefs know that he was not intending to invade Cuba anytime soon. So essentially, he quashed it. He said, we're not doing this. So it's all, just a proposal, but it is frightening to think that, you know, the top...
Yeah, somebody considered this.
Right.
As a possibility. But of course, that a lot of what you've just described sounds like a draft for the script of Loose Change, so, you know, the 9/11
right.
conspiracy movie. It's like,
right.
It is exactly what is being proposed as has happened over 9/11. I mean, this, you know, this forms the basis of a lot of the contemporary conspiracy theories.
Right. Well, you know, it did take 30-something years for it to come out.
Sure.
Written in 1962, and it was finally released in 1999. Ironically, it came out as a result of Oliver Stone's conspiracy movie about the Kennedy assassination, JFK, that aroused so much you know, anger and concern in the United States about the Kennedy assassination that in the mid-1990s, Congress passed a law saying that there should be a special commission that went through all of the Kennedy records and declassified anything that might have to do with the assassination to convince people that everything was out there. And so the hope was that people would now look at these literally millions of documents and say, okay, there is no proof that anyone in the U.S. government killed the president. But as a result, you have these wave of declassifications in the late 90s that prove all of the U.S. conspiracies against Castro's Cuba, and Operation Northwoods is one of these. And it comes out in 99 and gets a little bit of attention, but not much. And then after the attacks of September 11, 2001, a lot of 9/11 conspiracy theorists start looking at Northwoods and saying, okay, this is the template. This is exactly what they were planning in 1962. They actually executed in 2001.
I've just sort of posited the theory that it's perhaps ludicrous to believe in conspiracy theories because all of the examples of old attempts at conspiracy theories are in the records for anybody to see. But, you know, another key thing to point out here is that whenever these conspiracy theories happen, nobody is actually ever punished. So there's loads of examples of things being done in, you know, Oliver North and the Iran-Contra affair is an obvious one that springs to mind that you talk about in the book. And more recently, there was the Louis Levy revealing that Valerie Plame Wilson was a CIA agent to discredit her husband's testimony about, you know, Iraq trying to buy uranium in Africa. These people always get pardoned. I mean, even the one person I can think of who was in some way punished and his career was ruined was Nixon, but then Nixon was pardoned as well. In which case, this also does lead credence to the idea that people don't trust the government because it seems like it doesn't matter about freedom of information. You can commit your conspiracy, you can do that. In 10 years' time, everyone will find out about it. You know, in 10 years' time, we'll find out that, you know, they were really behind 9/11. But it doesn't matter because nothing will happen, and they'll have been they'll be retired by then. There'll be another government in charge.
Right. Yeah. That's a very good point. You know, right now, the contemporary example is the torture.
Indeed. Yeah. I was going to raise this.
Right. Is that the documents are coming out to prove that the CIA tortured people, which you know is not only against international law but also against U.S. law. But the Obama administration is saying, you know, we very much want to look forward, not look back. And there are people at the CIA and even at the National Security Council in the White House who were a part of this torture program, who are still keeping their positions. And so this all contributes to Americans believing in conspiracy theories about their government and in thinking, well, there's nothing that we can do, and that the president is actually the captive of the military-industrial complex, or whatever you want to call it, and he can't, even when you have a president like Obama, who's very rhetorically committed to transparency, nothing really changes. Now, I think there's certainly a lot of truth in that, but at the same time, it's also true that there is a great difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration in terms of, you know, their policies and the extent to which they are releasing documents.
Well, let's be grateful for that. Staying with the various conspiracy theories and no, let me rephrase that. Staying with the various conspiracies of the Bush administration for a moment. You just mentioned the idea of the military-industrial complex, and you know this has been something that's been an idea since since post-World War II. But the theme that does unite virtually all of the conspiracy theories that you talk about in the book until the present day is the fact that as far as the American administration were concerned, all of these things were sort of, I suppose, fair game in the fight against the sort of implacable evil of communism as they saw it.
Right.
What seems to be slightly, I suppose, grubbier about the things that the Bush administration were involved in is, although there is the sort of cover of the idea of we're fighting a war on terror, a lot of the stuff they seem to get up to, I'm thinking of, you know, Bush's connection with the Saudis and things like Blackwater, the sort of security in Iraq and Halliburton stuff, it seems more about just blatantly enriching themselves and a very small sort of coterie of their friends rather than, you know, being an ideological battle. I mean, do you think that's possibly true?
Well, I think it works together. It works for them ideologically as well as economically. So you have that synergy going on. But I'm not sure that, Vice President Cheney was any less sincere than J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI for 50 years who fought the communists. I think in many of these cases, when you have the U.S. officials who conspire, they do so, they believe, for the best motives, that they honestly think this is the way to protect my country. And in a way, I think that's what makes them more interesting.
And more scary. Do you think? I mean, is that true? When you compare Cheney to J. Edgar Hoover, would it not be just as valid to say that Cheney was as cynical about these things as J. Edgar Hoover was? You could talk about J. Edgar Hoover caring about the fight against communism, but when you see things like when he's deliberately trying to undermine his own president, talking about how, his implacable hatred of Truman and how he was deliberately sort of conspiring.
Well, I think with all of these guys, after a while, they equate themselves with their country.
Yeah.
Right? So if somebody's out to get them, then that person is also out to get the United States, and so they are justified in using whatever means. I mean, Nixon was most explicit about this.
Mm-hmm.
On the tapes over and over again that, you know, these people are conspiring against me and therefore they're conspiring against the United States and I am justified in using whatever tools I have at my disposal to combat them. Hoover honestly believed that President Truman was weakening the nation by setting up the CIA, which took power away from the FBI. And so Hoover believed that he was serving the United States, serving the American people by secretly working against Truman's election in 1948. And obviously he was also serving himself since President Truman disliked Hoover so much and was trying to cut down on the power of the FBI. So again, it worked for Hoover as an individual to go against Truman, but he convinced himself, I think, that it was also best for his country.
Just to finish off with, I'd just like to look again at the idea about why we have the atmosphere of sort of conspiracy thinking. There's a great quote from somebody, I can't remember who it was, but one of the people working for the Bush administration, who says to the reporter Susskind, this idea that, you know, we're an empire now.
Right.
We basically make our own reality. And of course there's a similar famous one that's not in the book, but I think from Rumsfeld, where he took to reporters and say, you're members of the reality based community. I'm going to be a little bit more relativist than I would normally allow myself here, and so I was going to say, are conspiracy theorists basically ultimately making their own reality here? But I suppose we all are, aren't we? Is this what we all do? I mean, you know, this radio show professes to be interested in rationalism and the Enlightenment, but I suppose if I'm trying to weave my way through life with those beliefs, it's obvious that there inevitably involves believing certain things and certain truths and ignoring other sort of more inconvenient truths. I mean, are what conspiracy theorists doing just perhaps a slightly more extreme version of what we all do?
Well, you know, there's a certain validity to what you're saying there, and that conspiracy theories, there's a whole discipline of cultural studies that would say conspiracy theories are just a form of narrative. They're a way of telling a story, and telling a story in a complicated story in a simple way. There's black, there's white, there's a villain, there's a hero, and there's a simple solution to the problem in the story, which is that you expose the conspirators, and then you have heaven on earth. So to that degree, the 9/11 truth movement, they have a narrative about 9/11. And the Bush administration was trying to tell a different narrative about 9/11, which was also based on a conspiracy.
Well, I was going to raise that myself, because you say that, you know, the 9/11 truth movement, it's really difficult to pin down one narrative. There are hundreds of narratives. It's all like there's this just big bubble of competing theories. And from one website to another, it's very difficult to pin down a coherent time plan of what actually happened as far as a conspiracy theorist believes. I mean, they are quite insistent that, you know, either the government covered it up or they were involved in doing it, but it's much more difficult to find the how, isn't it? You know, it seems it's much easier to live in the, you know, in the fog than it is to have a conclusive idea of what actually happened.
Right. Well, but if you live in a democracy, you have to try and penetrate that fog, right? Because it's your duty as a citizen to try and understand, to find as close to the truth as possible. Because while it's true what you said about, you know, we're all sort of making up our own stories, that doesn't mean that everyone's story is equally valid.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so what historians do is they look at all of these various interpretations of the past and say, well, who has the best evidence? You know, who's making the best argument here? And so that's why it is important to look into, you know, what was the evidence that the Bush administration was using that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11? You know, does that evidence stand up once you really look at the sources of it? And it's the same way with the truth movement. If you look at what is it that they're saying really happened there and what is their evidence? But it does certainly, you know, you're right, it's a lot easier just living in a fog and sort of accepting whatever version most appeals to you. But I think it is important, if you do live in a country that expects you to participate in the governance, to really look into this and find what you think is the best interpretation based on the evidence.
I think that's a great point for us to end on. Kathy, thank you very much for speaking to Little Atoms today. It's been brilliant talking to you.
Well, thank you.